So we're going to be reading from Luke chapter 7, verses 1 through 17. It will be on the screen, but if you feel like following along in the tree version, you can certainly do so. Be reading from the ESV. So, this is right after Jesus has done some teaching to a great crowd. He goes through his beatitude account in the book of Luke in chapter 6, and we're going to pick right up right there. So, Luke chapter 7, verses 1 through 17. After he had finished all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. Now a centurion had a servant who was sick and at the point of death, who was highly valued by him. And when the centurion heard about Jesus, he sent to him elders of the Jews, asking him to come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they pleaded with him earnestly, saying, he is worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our nation, and he's the one who built us our synagogue. And Jesus went with them, and when he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying to him, Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof. Therefore, I didn't even presume to come to you, but say the word, and let my servant be healed. For I too am a man set under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes. And to another, come, and he comes. And to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him. And turning to the crowd that followed him, said, I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith. And when those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the servant well. Soon afterward, he went down to a town called Nain, and his disciples and a great crowd went with him, and as he drew near to the gate of the town, behold, a man who had died was being carried out, the only son of his mother. And she was a widow, and a considerable crowd from the town was with her. And when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her and said to her, do not weep. Then he came up and touched the bier, and the bearers stood still. And he said, young man, I say to you, arise. And the dead man sat up and began to speak, and Jesus gave him to his mother. Fear seized them all, and they glorified God, saying, a great prophet has arisen among us, and God has visited his people. And this report about him spread through the whole of Judea and the surrounding country. This morning, we're going to be talking about fertile faith. Fertile faith. And I made the joke on Facebook last night, the dad joke, if I may, that we're not going to be talking about babies. We're not going to be talking about faith that makes babies today. But we are going to be talking about this. If you get nothing else out of today, hear this. Faith that acknowledges Jesus' authority and trusts him. So faith that acknowledges Jesus' authority and trusts him makes you fertile ground for God's kingdom to grow. Last week, we started talking about the kinds of things that make us fertile ground or good soil for God's kingdom to grow in us. And from these two stories this morning, we discover that faith is one of the key things that makes us fertile ground for God's kingdom to grow in us. But I ask you, what kind of faith? What kind of faith are we talking about? There are a lot of definitions of faith out there, many ideas about what faith is, and these two stories that we're going to look at this morning, they stand in stark contrast to what a lot of the misconceptions in our world are, two in particular. Two big misconceptions about faith. The first one, most of our world, a lot of our world thinks that faith is something you're born into. That you're born into Christian faith, or you're born into Muslim faith, you're born into Jewish faith, or, you know, some other kind of faith. But we can rule that out. We just read it. In this first story, the centurion was just that, a centurion. He wasn't Jewish. He wasn't born into faith in God, but he became someone who had faith in God. So this faith that we're after isn't something you're just born into. That's the first thing. Second thing. Another misconception, another wrong idea about faith out there, and you've probably heard this one. You have to have a lot of it. Faith is something you have to have a lot of. I mean, if you have a lot of faith, things will start to happen for you. You'll start to see things in your life. But if you paid attention to the second story, this mother is simply a broken woman heading down the road to bury her son. She doesn't express any kind of great faith or awesome faith. She's not standing guard over her son's body, fighting everyone off until Jesus gets there because she has such a large, great faith. No, and she knows that she knows that she knows that when Jesus shows up, he's gonna heal him. No, that's not what we read. So this faith that we're after, it isn't about quantity or putting on a big show or display. No. There are lessons here for us to learn about faith in this passage. The kind of faith that will turn us into fertile ground for God's kingdom to begin to grow. Grow through us and allow us to bear fruit in this world. So the first thing let's talk about faith that stops Jesus in his tracks. It's pretty wild. Faith that stops Jesus in his tracks. Did you notice it all in that first story about the centurion? We never actually read that Luke writes, well, let him be healed. Jesus doesn't say that, not in Luke's account. Luke doesn't bother recording the actual moment Jesus heals the centurion's servant. Because the emphasis here, what is more important in the story, is that it's the faith the centurion demonstrates. So Luke chooses to focus on what Jesus said about this man's faith and how he responds. This is what stops Jesus in his tracks. Let's look at it again, verse 9. When Jesus heard these things, the things the centurion was saying, he marveled at him. Jesus marveled at man. And turning to the crowd that followed him said, I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith. What was so impressive about this man's faith? Let's take a peek at what the centurion says. In verse 6, he was not far from the house, Jesus, was not far from the house when the centurion sent friends to say to him, Lord, don't trouble yourself, for I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. That's why I didn't even consider myself worthy to come to you. But say the word, my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. I tell this one to go, and he goes. Tell this one to come, and he comes. And I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. So what stands out about what this man does? What stands out about what he says? The first thing is you'll notice that he's humble. The centurion is humble and doesn't consider himself deserving of anything from Jesus. As we read, the Jewish elders they come to him and they identify this centurion as being worthy and deserving to have Jesus come to him. But you don't see that response from the centurion. He doesn't feel this way. No, he says, I'm not worthy to even have you come under my roof. He recognizes who he is. The centurion recognizes who he is, but he also recognizes who Jesus is. I'll share a scripture with you. Paul writes in the book of Romans, chapter 12, verse 3, for by the grace given me, I say to every one of you, this is Paul speaking, by the grace given me, I say to every one of you, do not think of yourself more highly than you ought to. The centurion's humble. He realizes that he's not worthy. He recognizes who Jesus is, and then also who he is. The second thing you notice is he recognizes Jesus' real, authentic authority. Real, authentic authority. Jesus has real, authentic authority. He doesn't arrive on scene and put on a show. The centurion even says he wasn't expecting a show. He wasn't even expecting him to come to his house. This is a big, big point I want you to take away from this passage today. Jesus has real, authentic authority. In our world, we're plagued with inauthentic authority. People play pretend and fake authority, pretend authority at work, at home. You choose the setting. I work at a bank. And anybody else work at a bank in the... Just me. Yes. Maybe not. Hopefully I can paint this picture before you. Have you been to a bank? Have you visited a bank? All right, cool. So at the bank the other day, a customer comes in and they need to conduct a transaction, which is what you do when you go to a bank. And she'd been banking with us. This customer had been banking with us for a long time. And I found that out very quickly. She wanted to make a withdrawal. And when you make a withdrawal, what do? You sign a withdrawal slip. So she signs the withdrawal slip. I give it to her to fill out. And while she's doing that, I look her up in our software, in our system. And I couldn't find an ID. We didn't have a current ID on file. So I asked to see her ID. And that was my first mistake. She gave me a hard time. She hit me with, do you know how long I've been banking here? I've been a customer since before you were even alive. That's my ID. You don't need to see my ID. If you're a customer to bank, don't do that. And after some additional back and forth, she reluctantly provided me with her ID and was offended that she had to do so. And, you know, I get it, but because of her status as a lifetime customer, she assumed this level of authority that would make her the exception to having to provide proper ID. Even though I've never met this person in my life. Never met this person. But the centurion realizes that Jesus doesn't have fake authority or pretend authority. He has real, authentic authority. What else stands out about this man, the centurion? The third thing I took away from it that I want to share with you this morning is that you don't notice any kind of bargaining. There's no transaction. The centurion doesn't try to buy from or barter with Jesus to make him heal his servant. No. And also, Jesus, when he's asked to heal the centurion's servant, doesn't say, oh no, you got to do this first, you got to do that first. He doesn't ask for anything in return for providing that healing. There's no attempt at trade or transaction. And I want to share with you this morning, far too many of us have these types of transactional relationships in our lives. I guarantee every single one of us just thought of somebody. These relationships are toxic. You may ask why? Because you are always keeping score in a transactional relationship. You're always keeping track of who did this and who didn't do that, which means you're too busy to be truly loving, to be truly forgiving, or to be truly generous. Jesus doesn't intend for our relationship with him or with others to be transactional or some sort of exchange of goods. God, if you do this for me, I will never sin again. How many of you have heard someone say that? How many of you have said that, if you'll be honest? Jesus doesn't want your payment. He doesn't want your payment. The grace of God doesn't come with an invoice attached. He wants you to follow him by faith. He wants your life. And after all, think about it. I mean, I'm not sure how many finance wizards we have in the house today, but I'm assuming at least most of you have some sort of Excel sheet at home or spreadsheet or budgeting app or something that you use to keep track of your finances and your assets to make sure you calculate your net worth and what the car is worth, what the house is worth, how much equity you have, all those things. What could you possibly pay God? What could you possibly offer to God? You can't pay him. You can't pay him. I mean, that's silly to even think about. The centurion seems to understand that he has nothing to really offer God. He's depending totally on God's grace. Here's another thing we don't see. You don't see the centurion putting on a show. He doesn't try to prove to Jesus the amount of faith that he has by putting on some sort of act or some outward exuberant display. No, you don't see that. The entourage that he sends to greet him, his friend, is not to try to impress Jesus. It's out of a place of humbleness. How often do we put on a show to try to get Jesus to do something for us? Those seasons in your life where you pray a little harder, you fast a little bit longer, you go to church a little more often, you sing a little bit louder. God, I really mean it this time. And hear me, none of those are bad things. But what's the condition of the heart? The centurion doesn't put on a show. But that's not what stops Jesus in his tracks. That's not what impressed Jesus. Want to know what did? This right here. The centurion assumed and relied on Jesus' compassion. He assumed and relied on Jesus' compassion. He understood that of course Jesus would want to help me out. Of course Jesus cares. He's Jesus. What impressed Jesus is that the centurion is so sure of who he is. The centurion is so certain of who Jesus is. That's what stops Jesus in his tracks. So again, Luke doesn't even mention the healing. He focuses on Jesus' being so impressed and amazed with this man's faith that it literally stops him in his tracks. So what can we conclude about this kind of faith that stops Jesus in his tracks? Well, it humbly recognizes Jesus' authority and Jesus' compassion. It makes no bargains and puts on no show. It recognizes who Jesus is and, frankly, who we are, and places trust in him regardless of circumstances. Regardless of circumstances. This begs the question, you know, what would this kind of faith look like in our lives? I mean, I want you to think for a moment. Think about something that you've been praying about or hoping God would do something about in your life. How have you approached him? Has it been with humility? Has it been with recognition of Jesus' absolute authority, which he has? Have you been bargaining this for that? Have you been trying to convince Jesus of your faith by putting on a show or an act? Or have you been operating with the assumption that, of course Jesus cares deeply about what you're going through? And have you been choosing to rely on his compassion to either change the situation or get you through it? What keeps us from this kind of faith? Is it pride? Is it doubting this real, authentic authority that Jesus has? Is it not believing that you don't have to earn it or convince him? Is it not trusting in his grace and compassion to carry you through? I mean, I'll tell you right now, this is my whole testimony. This is my story. This is how I began to live in a relationship with Jesus. My salvation, I couldn't understand that salvation. And faith was a free gift from Jesus, which it is. Salvation and faith are free gifts. It wasn't fair in my head that I didn't have to earn it with him. It wasn't fair to me that I didn't have to prove myself to Jesus. And it took me a while to kind of understand that he knows my heart. And what was getting in the way was me. It was my pride. I was getting in the way, doubting what he says, doubting what his word says, not believing that he has the authority to change me or change the things around me. I struggled for many years, and if I'm being honest with you, those thoughts still enter my mind. But daily, more and more and more and more, we begin to trust him. I begin to trust him. But maybe we're not there. Maybe you're not there. Maybe you're not the centurion and you can't identify with this great faith that he has. Maybe you don't have the kind of faith that stops Jesus in his tracks. But let me ask you, do you maybe, just maybe, have the kind of faith that would allow Jesus to stop you in yours? Let's take a peek at the second story. Let's see what we can take away from the kind of, we just talked about the kind of faith that would stop Jesus in his tracks. Now, let's talk about the kind of faith that allows Jesus to stop us in ours, you in yours. This second story about the mother, about the widow. Imagine for a moment, just imagine, every one of us at some point in time, I guarantee, has been to some sort of funeral in our lives. But imagine you're at a funeral and somebody interrupts it. I mean, I've seen some weird stuff happen at funerals, if I'm being honest with you, and it always makes me uncomfortable, even if I'm not participating in it. You know, they're wheeling the casket out, and someone steps in front of it and tells everyone, "Stop! Stop right now! Don't go another foot." What do you imagine might happen? That's what's happening here. And in this woman who already lost her husband, she's now burying her son, her only son. Picture for a moment the pain and the agony she must be experiencing. It's tough losing a family member. But losing your husband and then losing your only son? These changes, these losses would have dramatically affected her life. And on top of that, it would have left her, if you know anything about the culture at the time, I know Anders has talked about it in the past, and you've probably studied it on your own, a woman by herself back then, it's vulnerability for her. It's a cultural vulnerability. It would have left her super vulnerable in society as a widowed woman, no husband, no son. Imagine the hopelessness. I mean, is this what her life has turned into? Just one long march toward death, and she's next in line? And really, I'm sort of trying to paint a picture for you, but if we look at what Scripture says, according to Scripture, we know these two things about her. That right now she's completely alone, and that she's crying. She's weeping. But she lets Jesus stop her son's funeral procession. She lets Jesus stop the death marks that her life had become. Look at it. There's no great cry of faith. There's no grand declaration of faith. There's barely a whimper of faith left. The tiniest expression of faith to whimper as she lets Jesus stop the pallbearers. But she does it. And that whimper of faith, where all she really did was allow Jesus to stop her in her tracks, to interrupt her death march, that whimper of faith was all it took for her to become fertile, good soil for the kingdom of God to show its power. So what can we take away from the widow? Sometimes, all it takes is enough faith to allow Jesus to stop you in your tracks. To genuinely, sincerely trust that nothing is over until Jesus says it's over. We've all heard the expression, it's not over until the fat lady sings. Well, it's not over until Jesus speaks. And you're all going to cope with this, I know you will. But have you ever heard someone else say, or maybe you've said this yourself, God does not understand what I'm going through. God doesn't understand what I'm going through. How could he? He doesn't know what it's like to be me. He doesn't know what it's like to walk in my shoes. He's up there, right? I'm down here. He doesn't care what's going on. But I want you to think about this with me for a moment. In worship team, you can start coming back. Look at this story. Look at the characters in this story. The mother, the widow, this woman just loses her son, the suffering, the pain of losing her one and only son. You think God doesn't get it? God knows that pain. God lost his one and only son. The centurion was desperate for a way to help this person, this servant he cared about. He wanted to stop him from having to have suffering, and he wanted to stop the inevitable death that was coming, but the centurion found himself, despite his powerful position, despite his powerful place in a military position, he finds himself as helpless as the rest of us. Jesus wants desperately to spare us from the pain of sin and death. And Jesus gave up his position to take our death and suffering upon himself. This widow felt utterly alone now that her husband and son were gone. Jesus suffered ultimate loneliness. Ultimate loneliness on the cross, in a way that you and I will never understand. But he did that so that you and I will never have to be alone. The centurion was afraid the end was near. The mother was afraid that the end had already happened. But hear me this morning. Jesus demonstrates that nothing is over until he says it is finished. One of my favorite quotes is by an American writer named Richard Bach, and you've probably seen it or read it at one point. What the caterpillar calls the end of the world, the master calls the butterfly. I love that. What the caterpillar calls the end of the world, the master calls the butterfly. Look, I'm not sure if we were in biology class, skip biology class, but spoiler alert, caterpillars turn into butterflies. They eat a bunch of stuff, they wrap themselves in a big old blanket they make themselves, and like weeks, months, years later, I don't know how long, they come out with wings. Kind of weird. But imagine for a moment the caterpillar, right? The world's closing around them, darkness is surrounding them, they're going dark. But perspective is everything. Everything depends and proceeds from your point of view. When you allow your perspective and point of view to shift because of your faith, you start to see things a little differently. When your faith allows Jesus to stop you in your tracks, God's kingdom can begin to grow in you. Even if you're like the widow and your faith has been whittled down to just a whimper, Jesus doesn't wait for you to send messengers to him. He doesn't wait for you to send your entourage to him. He doesn't wait for you to put on a show. He steps into your life and he asks you to trust him and let him interrupt your death march. You may not have the kind of faith, listen, you may not have the kind of faith that stops Jesus in his tracks. So have the kind of faith that will let Jesus stop you in yours.